Mary Roach has got a new one out. She is the author of Bonk, Stiff, Spook, and now Gulp. This is the latest one. Adventures on the Elementary Canal. Mary Roach, Gulp, period, Gulp, period. Because, I mean, it's really not about gulping. It's more about all the other stuff, which you really can't call a book. Because how would you spell it, number one? Mary Roach is online with us from Oakland, California. Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Got another one-worder here for a one-word book.
We done it again with the one-worder.
Done it again. Has this long been a fascination of yours, the Elementary Canal and its ramifications?
I like to eat, but I guess I seem to be fascinated with the kind of the cruder elements of the human body.
You do. You've shown that before.
There's a little bit of the 12-year-old boy inside me.
Yeah. And I mean, in doing all this now, you've studied this from one end to the other, basically. Is there one thing that stands out as the most shocking discovery you made on the Elementary Canal?
Shocking.
Shocking.
Well, I don't know if this is shocking. This was gently surprising.
Okay. That's better.
People have two sets of nostrils. You have a set of internal nostrils.
Oh.
In the back of your mouth, they're called the internal nostrils. So there.
That's a lousy name for them. They should have their own name anyhow. They are in the back of your neck? Where are they, around the epiglottis around there or something like that?
Yeah, they're in the back of the mouth. So you can, when you chew your food or drink your wine or your gin, in my case, the aromas go up into the nose so you can thereby appreciate them more fully. So you should be thankful
for
your internal nostrils.
You smell it twice.
Smell
it again later, actually, too, so it's three times. Three smells per meal. There's been a lot of, tasting food, they say tasting food is not tasting, it's smelling, or that it's even seeing, or that it's hearing. Right?
Yeah.
Where do you fall on this?
Yeah, that's true. The hearing thing is kind of cool. There's this study they did, those people, they gave people potato chips, mm-hmm. and they had them chew them up, and they had to rate their freshness, and if they put headphones on them, and they secretly, it's like the old Sanka ad, they see like, secretly, we've changed the frequency of the sound of these potato chips. So they mask the higher frequency or they make the chips quieter, and now people will say, oh, these potato chips are stale. These are no good. Mm-hmm. So you are kind of eating with your ears.
Yeah. So is that the primary sensation we have when we're eating? We want to get the right crunch, right? Is that?
Yeah, you want the crunches. Crunch is important, I guess, evolutionarily, if that's a word.
It is now.
Yeah. You tend to want to eat crisp, crunchy fruits and vegetables because they're fresh. They're not stale or mushy or rotten or awful. So we're programmed to kind of like crispy, crunchy. And then the snack food people have capitalized on that by making optimally crispy, crunchy foods that, unlike fruits and vegetables, don't have a lot of nutrition. But there you go.
Okay. I'm going to just throw some things at you. There's so much ground covered in your book there. Can I just throw some things at you and get a feedback from you?
Throw them.
Noxious flatus.
Yeah.
Not a Roman emperor.
Did you want me to comment?
Noxious flatus. Not the joke so much, but that's the best I've done so far this morning, actually.
I like the pay up the wazoo as you go or whatever.
Thank you. Noxious flatus. So, I mean, what can you explain what that is and why and what that means?
That is smelly gas.
Smelly gas.
Smelly gas. Okay, and that is because
normal.
That is normal. It's because of hydrogen sulfide, which is a breakdown product of meat, red meat, cruciferous vegetables, your cabbage, your kale, your broccoli, all those.
Oh, yeah.
Those give you the smelly component. Most of most of your farts are not smelly. Hydrogen,
no,
methane.
I keep saying that.
As long as I've known you.
Yes. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's actually a bouquet, isn't it? There's several chemicals involved.
Yes, there is. There's several chemicals. There's three or four of the sulfur compounds that are making things smelly. And there are things that one could do if one was so inclined, although I don't really see why one would be so inclined.
Yeah.
But because most people really have no objection to the smell of their own when you get right down to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there are pills that somebody came up with, and there are special charcoal-lined underwear pads. There are cushions that you can put on your office chair. However, the gastroenterologist that I thought had the best solution was a guy named Dr. Mike Jones, and he said, when I get patients who tell me that they've got a problem with this, I say, get a dog.
And blame the dog.
And blame the dog.
Yeah. No, that works for me. Tina is terrible gas. My puggle. Before we leave this particular subject, how come men do and women don't?
What, have smelly gas?
I mean, have any. Admit it. Men seem to be the only ones who admit it in the universe that we know of.
And yeah, because...
Is that true? Has that been verified? Or?
Well, supposedly women have a slightly higher concentration of hydrogen sulfide, so they supposedly smell a little worse, but I'm not buying this.
No.
I'm just not. It has mostly to do with what you eat, so I think it's kind of hogwash. But anyway, the men make up for this with the larger than average volume of each passage, I believe.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. What did you say? I was trying to stifle one. Okay, all right. Okay, let's leave that because that's neither here nor there. Stomach snakes.
Yes.
Interesting.
Stomach snakes and stomach frogs and stomach slugs.
All sorts of, mostly amphibians in the stomach or reptiles.
Yeah. This is mostly in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. when people didn't have much of an understanding about what was going on in their interior, and they would interpret pain and rumblings and weird sensations, they would become convinced that they had swallowed some frog or snake eggs and that they had hatched inside them. And you would find these case reports in the medical literature of people who supposedly had a frog living inside them for years and years. And then there, one enterprising physician had an idea of how to debunk this. He took because sometimes the patients would actually come in and say, look here, this is the frog. And I found it one morning in my living room, and I believe this is the one that was inside me, and it must have escaped. And so he looked inside the frog and found partially digested insects, which suggested that, in fact, the frog had not spent the last 3 years inside a human stomach.
Unless the man ate insects as well.
You're just going to be difficult, aren't you?
No, I'm just saying there are possibilities. But, I mean, because there's that boy who coughed up all those frogs, right? That's sort of the record holder for frogs and newts and toads.
Yeah, there was that boy. I forget what the number was, but that was, And that whole, there's the song, the old lady who swallowed the fly.
Oh.
And that was why.
Good. That was a reference I was trying to get in there.
Yeah.
Okay. Alka-Seltzer rockets.
Alka-Seltzer. This is a serious topic. If you tend to overindulge in a very vigorous way, and then you feel horrible and you overdo with Alka-Seltzer, see, this is when you can be in danger of bursting the stomach, because the gas produced by too much Alka-Seltzer could rupture the stomach. It's very hard to burst a human stomach, but if you really want to do it, Alka-Seltzer is the way to go, and you need only consult the internet and see the Alka-Seltzer rocket videos that are out there.
Yeah. Is there an actual rocket involved in that, or is that just an expression?
Yeah, NASA is involved in this. Yeah.
NASA,
yeah.
Okay.
It's just that you can do it with a little film canister, and you can put the Alka-Seltzer in, and the top will blow off, and it's very dramatic.
Okay. Is this the same thing that you reference in blowing the roof off the hog barn?
No, that has to do with the combustibility of hydrogen and methane, which are the two largest components of flatus, as you like to say.
Yeah. Is it flatus?
I don't know. I think it's either. Okay. I say flatus, you say flatus.
Okay. That's blowing it out. Okay. And that's methane. Now, we have so many cows here in Wisconsin, we take them for granted, but they are, and the methane they produce actually could be, I always thought if we could hook them up to tubes or something somehow, but which end would you actually hook up on a cow?
You would hook up, yes, this is a question a lot of people would get wrong, but not me, and not you. The front end, you would hook it up to the front end. They're not actually blowing it out the rear, like us.
No. So they're burping or belching methane.
But they have a special adaptation where they can kind of shift around the machinery in their neck and they gently exhale. They just exhale it. They're not even burping. Because have you heard a cow burp?
No.
Well, all right,
I'm not that close to cows. Bunnies, I probably would hear that if they did.
Bunnies do other interesting things.
Yeah, they do. And my puggle is very fond of them as a result. There's nothing like a good bunny poop, according to Tina.
Yeah.
And you would agree with that, because I read in the book that that's actually still good stuff.
There's good eating there.
There's good eating there. That's what they say. Yeah.
The bunnies themselves will re-ingest it.
Right.
Okay.
And we'll come back to that. But, you know, one of the things that aren't the cow's stomach is kind of a miracle of nature, isn't it? I mean, they have more than one. But
Yeah. They have a... The main stage is the rumen, and that is
the rumen.
It's like a giant composter, and you can go to an agricultural school, and if you're lucky, there'll be one of those fistulated cows, which has the hole in the side. And
we got one here.
You got one?
Yeah, at UW. Yeah.
Have you ever stuck your arm in there?
No, it's just no.
Live a little.
That's an exit.
No, not in that end.
Oh, okay.
No, they cut a hole in the side right by the rumen, and then you can while they're eating, you can put your arm in there. And I did this and feel that.
Why would you do that?
Well, because I'm a curious gal.
Okay, and if you put your arm inside a cow while it's ruminating, what do you feel exactly?
It's a great big composter, so you feel a lot of heat. It's very hot in there. Mm-hmm. Plus, it's there's these powerful contractions, so it's kind of industrial feeling. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
The cow is utterly bored the entire time.
Can they actually digest the magnets?
The magnets?
Yeah, the cows eat anything, all this metal stuff, and then they put magnets in there to gather it all up. But then what happens to the magnets?
The magnets, there's a the first, I think the first stomach is the one where the magnets are.
Okay.
And then I don't think they're not in the rumen. But they don't. Yeah. It's hard to digest a magnet.
Because you're a farm girl, aren't you? Didn't you grow up on a farm?
I grew up in New Hampshire, but we didn't have any cows.
Okay.
No.
Let's talk about the Fletcher thesis for a while. This is the guy who believed in mastication.
Yes, that's
right. He made mastication a household word.
Yes, hypermastication. Vigorous, lengthy mastication. Lots and lots of mastication.
Mastication.
Chewing.
Yeah, and he must have been just fun to be around, because he would chew, he chewed a leek like 700 and something times.
722 times.
Yeah.
Yeah, Horace Fletcher had this idea that he was a nutritional economist, that's what he called himself, and he believed that if you chewed the food incredibly thoroughly, you would extract more benefit from it, more calories and more protein and whatever else was in it. So you could then eat only half as much of it, thereby saving money. So he had this idea that the nation could save, you could basically cut the budget by having poor people, eat half as much at these soup kitchens and things like that. So he was a kind of an unusual welfare reform in person.
Yeah. Was he at Harvard? Is that where he was?
His papers wound up at Harvard. Oh. He himself didn't go there, but he left his papers to Harvard, and they dutifully have kept them, and they are there. And I went and spent an afternoon. And Horace Fletcher, it was maddening, because he was such an efficiency buff that he had typed on both sides of the page and with no margin, so the papers were just crammed with this. And not terribly interesting either, but anyway, but he had friends in high places, and the Fletcherizing was a pretty surprisingly big fad in the United States.
Yeah.
Franz Kafka was a Fletcherizer.
That's no kidding.
Yeah.
Well, that explains a lot of things. Then, in
Kafka.
The Brits, do they still don't care for Eskimo food? Is that true?
They've probably become a little more adventurous, but the Brits in polar exploration were done in partly by their refusal to eat the way the locals would eat and to partake in what the locals would eat, which was a lot of organ meats and unsavory, frightening bits and pieces of marine mammals. But those bits and pieces were the most nutritious, and so the locals do quite well up there, and the Brits would perish.
Yeah.
Up there and down there, we're talking both poles.
Yeah.
There were, but mostly in the north, where you have the people eating the various organ meats.
Yeah, and they did better in adapting in India. Apparently, they seemed to like the curries and so forth.
They did. They accepted the curries. I don't know why they couldn't accept the raw caribou kidney and things like that.
Yeah.
They seem to have trouble with that.
Which brings up the question of revulsive food, or food revulsions and stuff. We can't seem to agree on what is revulsive. Are there some universally revulsive things to eat?
It seems that there are not. I think if you take any edible, safe substance, you will find a culture somewhere that thinks it's just the best thing to order on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking fermented cow urine is a condiment in Sudan. That just came to mind. They're just a tremendous variety of parts of the beast that you or I wouldn't go near that other cultures are like, give me that. That's the best part.
Okay. But then the feeling of revulsion, taste revulsion, that is a human characteristic. But causes it is entirely cultural?
Yes, that's right. In the United States, we are particularly squeamish about organ meats. We export some, I have the figure in the book, it's a crazy amount of brains and organ meats and lips and tails. We really are we eat a very small sliver of the animal, and other countries import those from us. And it's just you grow up, but when you're a little kid, you come into the world, you don't have any sense of what is disgusting. And this was proved by this psychologist who studied disgust. His name was Paul Rozin, and he did this experiment where he presented kids, 16 to 29 months, I think they were, and he put in front of them a variety of disgusting foods, including artificial dog dew crafted from peanut butter with Limburger cheese for the odor. And he presented that as dog dew. And 55% of the kids ate the dog dew. 38%, I think, ate the sterilized grasshopper. Whatever it was, they had no sense of this is not good to eat. I won't go near it. But as they get older, around a few years old, they start to eat the way their parents eat. They eat the way the people on TV eat.
Mm-hmm.
So
if your parents eat dog dew, you will too, basically.
That's right. You can continue eating dog dew throughout your adult life.
Pig testicles at Ball State. You want to deal with that? Your line here.
Yeah. I was trying to get at. I was trying to figure out: are there any culture? Is there any food that no one will go near? And what about the genitalia? Who eats that? And I came upon this woman, Deanna Petricelli, I believe, Puricelli or something. Anyway, I was. She said, yes, indeed, we are working on a project to introduce the public to pork testicles.
Mm-hmm.
And she turned out to work at Ball State University, which I like very much.
You gotta like that. How far has this gotten? Still in the planning stages?
I need to check back in with her and see what's up.
That's so they'd use the final. Now, doesn't that go into? That must go into something. That must be used by someone somewhere, one would think.
Well,
because others are, other types.
Yeah, you have your novelty festivals with testicles out in Wyoming.
Testicle festivals? Are there?
Festivals.
Yeah, I guess there are because mountain oysters and all that.
Rocky Mountain oysters. That's right.
They're very people like those. Well, we had them on stage when we were in Oklahoma or someplace, and we had a jar of them. And I said, anyone want to come up and join me? All women came up. Three or four women. No guy would come up and eat it. So, you know, make of that what you will. That was kind of strange. Cat crack.
Yeah, cat crack.
Yeah.
Pyrophosphates.
Now, that's really, this is interesting because it has to deal with not science, but sort of marketing, I guess.
Well, yeah, the people who make pet food have kind of an interesting challenge. They have to create something that is appealing both to the dog or cat and also to the owner of the dog or cat, who's the one who's opening the can or the bag. Mm-hmm. And if it smells like dog, a dog will go crazy over the smell of, say, putrescine, cadaverine. These are compounds of decomposing protein. The dogs are like, ah, give me that. But the owner.
That was good. Yeah.
Was that good?
Yeah.
Yeah. The owner doesn't want anything to do with it, so they have to find something
in between
that smells good to both parties. Taste isn't so important.
And for cats, what is this compound exactly?
Okay, yeah. So pyrophosphate is this compound that it's been referred to as cat crack. It's a taste that cats love, and we can't taste it. There was a little bottle of it at the company that I was at, and I asked to try it, and it doesn't taste like anything. It's water with a little strangeness to it. But cats love it. So there's all kinds of interesting differences between people and
Where does it come from, and what does it simulate for a cat?
Nobody knows knows why they like it or what it tastes like for them.
Yeah.
They just know they love it.
They can't resist it, huh?
They can't resist it.
Yeah.
You
know
what
I found?
Put that on anything and a cat will eat it.
You know what I sort of found? I mean, most of this research is very interesting, and the people are totally into it and stuff, but it was kind of, the spit researchers were kind of sad, I thought. Because no one respects their discipline.
It's true.
Yeah.
Spit gets no respect.
No.
It deserves a lot of respect.
Are there a lot of people in spit?
I only found one.
Uh-huh.
I found one dead one from years ago.
Oh.
Irwin Mandel had devoted his life to spit.
The father of spit.
The father of spit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I found a beautiful Italian woman, Erica Saletti,
mm-hmm.
who is an expert in saliva, and it's tough for her. She went to a conference once with a bunch of dental people, and she said she came back to her room and called her boyfriend in tears, saying, "They think of it as moistening, and that's all."
Yeah. Yeah.
It does so much more for you.
It does.
It does.
What is her research aimed at as far as spit goes?
They're trying to understand
spit.
Spit. Yes. Well, also, I think, you know, when if something goes wrong with your spit machinery, because
mm-hmm.
If you can't make your own saliva, you're in a world of trouble, because when you eat or drink anything acidic, it will, without saliva to dilute the acid, and which it does very effectively. If you take a sip of red wine and you're paying attention, you'll feel this gush of saliva coming in like the cavalry. It's to dilute the acid and protect your tooth enamel. So it's pretty, when you don't have saliva, your teeth start to fall apart. So they need to know how to create artificial saliva. And part of it is just, understanding the body.
Mm-hmm.
Always
okay.
A good thing.
So nothing, in other words.
That's why there's
not
only
much
one of them.
You can't really advance the science because it's not really a complex substance. Spit is it chemically? What is it?
Yes, it is. It's got antibacterial stuff. It's got antiviral.
Oh.
It's got histatins, which help close wounds. If you keep a mouse from licking its wounds, they won't heal as quickly.
Oh.
And wounds in your mouth heal faster than wounds on your skin. There's all kinds of amazing stuff in saliva.
Well, is
you
that,
must respect saliva.
I'm sorry. Now I have more respect for it, even as we speak. It's no longer spittle to me, I'll tell you that. But is this at all related to the thing that I was talking about, babies pacifiers, if the parents suck on it? Is that the saliva transfer that somehow gives them added autoimmunity or something like that?
I haven't heard
that,
but it makes sense because that this is the new thing now, all kinds of bodily fluid transplants.
Yes.
Yes.
Like Elton John and that sort of thing.
Did Elton have a fluid transplant?
No, I don't know. No, Elton John is the one who, I'm thinking of Prince Charles.
I don't know where you're going with
that. I don't either, but I don't know. Elton John was the one who would eat food and spit it out, right?
Oh,
and that's
yeah.
how he lost it.
Well, he didn't. He was he somebody put in one of the tabloids that he was doing, it's an eating disorder called chew and spit.
Chew and spit.
Yeah, where you don't swallow, you chew it and you spit it out.
Right.
Kind of a catch and release scenario.
But he doesn't, or he didn't.
No, he doesn't.
Didn't.
He won the lawsuit.
Okay.
Yeah, he doesn't do it, but they said he did.
Prince Charles, I guess, was the colonic irrigation guy, dude.
Did Prince Charles is a fan of the enema?
That's what I heard. Yes.
Oh, is that right? You didn't hear that from me, though.
No. Did you hear about did you hear any of that? It's true of royalty in general, isn't it? They tend towards that.
They tend toward that. There was one of the Georges, I think. I don't know what. George the second. I don't know.
Maybe
which,
the third.
Probably the third. Yeah, probably the third. He was one of the. He loved. He was a big whoever he was, whichever number. He loved them so much. He gave them to his dogs. His dogs would get enemas too.
Ooh. Well, that's a dead end conversation, isn't it?
That's
the problem with this book. A lot of it is stuff that you can't really talk about in polite conversation. Yet it's fascinating.
And yet here we are.
And here we can read it to ourselves and go, "Oh boy, how about that there." The straining at stool theory, okay. Which is, and Elvis's demise is in here, and it's maybe not something we can just glance over right at the moment now, but that was pretty shocking as well.
That was shocking and sad. I was going to say
yes.
it's a moving story.
Or not. Yeah. Well, it's in there though. You have to buy
it's
the book.
There.
Buy the
it's
book.
In there.
That'll be the payoff. Buy the book and realize, and you can find out what actually happened to Elvis in there. And we'd be amiss or remiss, I think, if we didn't mention the miracle peristalsis in all this, because it's really behind everything, isn't it?
It is. Peristalsis is it's kind of like a stadium wave of contractions.
It is exactly.
It starts and it keeps going, and that's how you swallow, and it also moves stuff along through the intestines. And
right.
If you can't do that, if you some people are born without nerves along a stretch of the colon, so the muscles can't be activated, and they're in a whole world of trouble too. That's sort of the one of the theories with Elvis is that the reason he was so constipated. There, I gave it away.
Okay.
Was that he might have had it's called Hirschsprung's, where you have a stretch of colon where the muscle movements can't happen, and so everything gets backed up.
Okay.
So stop her. Somebody stop her.
Stop her. Right. And just one more thing. Can an alligator fight its way out of a python?
It cannot. But there are photographs that make it appear as though it can. But no, once you're... what is amazing to me is that a python can take down an adult alligator. Mm-hmm. Those suckers can really pull in the large game. So, but once you're in there, in a python...
You're done.
You can't move, so there's no way you could kick your way out. But the photographs that people have seen on the internet, it was a complicated story of a pre-existing weak spot in the python.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, too, a man swallowed by a whale or a tiger shark. Is he done?
Because
they swallow him whole, right? There's no chewing.
Okay, the best whale, if you're going to be swallowed by a whale, the best one is a sperm whale because they feed by suction. They don't chew their food. They just pull it in. Mm-hmm. And the opening is big enough that a man could fit through into the...
Comfortably.
Stomach compartment.
Yes.
Comfortably. And let's say he's got an oxygen tank because he's been scuba diving. So he's got some oxygen, okay, and there's no gastric acid in this particular stomach, so that's good.
Yeah, and he has a smartphone or something for entertainment.
And he's got a smartphone. Uh-huh, yeah, and he's downloaded some things to watch. So he's all right. The only problem is that whales tend to chew their food with their stomach. They have a lot of powerful stomach contractions, so it wouldn't be very comfortable.
But conceivably, he could get. Has it been documented now where a man has survived that situation?
Yeah, no. There was a story that made the rounds about a guy named James Bartley, and supposedly he was found inside a sperm whale, but that's been debunked, sadly.
That's been poo-pooed.
That's been poo-pooed. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's disappointing, actually. Any of these outrageous things that actually happen, swallowed by things and things crawling out of things, or having snakes in your stomach. All undocumented?
There was the most persistent myth these days is that the mealworm will eat its way out of the stomach of your pet reptile or frog or whatever it is. And I witnessed with a urethral endoscope, which is a very skinny tube that with a light and a camera. I was in a lab where they put that down into the stomach of a lizard and a frog that had just eaten a live mealworm. And there was no truth to it. The mealworm does not eat its way out of the stomach. But that was the best contender for somebody who could live in there and make their way out.
Okay, well.
Yeah.
I guess that's a spoiler. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
If you're going to read Gulp. But Elvis is still in there, and really it's worth getting just for that. Thank you, Mary Roach, as always. Look forward to the next one. By the way, are you going to Mars? And I notice you packed for Mars. Are you going to go in this one way to Mars?
Are you kidding me? No. Oh, no. I go to the moon, but not to Mars, no.
Especially you got to stay. That's a little weird, isn't it?
You got to stay. I know. Yeah. Well, some people, just think of it as immigration.
Yeah.
We'll put it in the
bill.
Immigration.
We'll put it in the bill. Thank you, Mary Roach. Mary Roach, ladies and gentlemen. Gulp is the latest one. Read it. Get it and read it.